Check, check. Okay, we're good to go. So first, I was just wondering if you could give kind of a brief description of how this specific center in Wichita was started, what went behind starting it specifically, what went behind the location, and also was it associated with the Karma Kagyu lineage from the get-go, from the beginning?
Yeah, so that it started with the Karma Kagyu lineage. Greg Smith was the guy who started the center, and we actually started meeting in his house. And I actually came in after the initial. He brought in Kathy Wesley back in 1996, either 95 or 96, and they met at Borders Bookstore over on Rock Road, and that's where the core group formed. And then we, shortly after that, he brought in Bartatuka Rinpoche from KTD, and that's where I started. I saw Bartatuka, and that was in 1996, in the spring of 1996, spring, summer of 96. And we had at Pine Valley Church, and we had probably 200 people that were there. It was an excellent teaching. And I started meeting at Greg's house, and we would meet for 3 hours every Sunday. We would do an hour of sitting, we'd do an hour of chenrezig, and then we'd do an hour of book discussion. And Greg has an encyclopedic knowledge of Buddhism, and I got an excellent foundation of Buddhism through Greg Smith. It was Karma Kagyu from the beginning. So, and Lama Kathy is a lama from Columbus, Ohio. And she had one of the first Kagyu centers, I understand, in the United States. And she's a student of Kempo Kartha Rinpoche. And that's who Greg initially started sitting with. He went to a teaching of Kempo Kartha when he was a student, I believe, at Ohio State University, a graduate student, I want to say. And started studying with Lama Kathy, and then he came after he graduated, got a job at Newman University as a psychology professor, and then started a center here in Wichita with the blessings of Kempo Kartha Rinpoche.
That's great. Could you discuss a little bit more about your own kind of how you began practicing with the group? Did you have experiences with other Buddhist groups? Was there something specifically about the Tibetan tradition in this lineage that spoke to you, as opposed to like other forms of Buddhism?
I don't know. Whenever you get asked that question, it becomes real. It's nice to talk about yourself. So, and then there's a lot of detail. Everybody, man, you can go back to when. You know, when I was a kid and walking through the park and I saw some guy meditating, really it happened. And I just remember it being having an impression on me. And then there was a Western show where, is it David Kane, was a kung fu, blind kung fu master? Right, so there was that kind of, and then there was all that I kind of grew up with in the 70s. But I think so that kind of laid the foundation. You just kept hints of it. But anyway, yeah, I got to it through, fundamentally, I was in D.C. and had my life kind of fell apart in D.C., bad relationship, and I had found two books at a bookstore on DuPont Circle, and one was Reign of Wisdom, and one was Cutting Through Spiritual Materialism, the book that we were talking about tonight, and they were phenomenal, but I didn't. When I came back to Wichita, I wanted to study Zen Buddhism because it's cleaner, you know, it's more analytical. There's no, you know, Tibetan Buddhism didn't appeal to me at the time because there's just so much. It's just so busy. It just doesn't. It's not as. I don't know if it's not. It's not that it's not necessarily as easily understood. It might be more easily understood than Zen Buddhism, for all I know. But it's like all what Greg Smith used to say. You just dance with the one that brung you. And so when I found, when I saw Bartoka Rinpoche and the way he was able to express himself in broken English and through a translator and talking about everything that I had started to come to realize when things were falling apart in D.C., and I realized what I'd been doing up to that point was being really selfish, and the things that were causing me problems, well, I don't even think I understood that. I just realized what I wanted to do was try and help people. What can I do to help people? Because right now, everything I do is just really aggressively self-centered. And I just let go. And I just sort of, it's one of those stories for me where it just, like, it just, the universe just opened up and kind of, you know, it's not like it, you think that there's a happy ending, but it just, there's another story that goes on and just keep going. But anyway, so then I fell into Buddhism and I was extremely grateful to Greg for doing it. And the emotion was really intense and it has driven my practice since. And I haven't really, I mean, it's, yeah, I don't know. Is that an answer?
Yeah.
Okay.
So, I read on your website, I know that the big monastery here in the States is in New York.
Yeah.
We spoke about it a little bit tonight,
yeah.
Woodstock. Is there a relationship between this organization and, like, a larger organization that's centered around that monastery? And, like, if there is, how does that affect practice here at the local level?
Yeah, absolutely. You're expected, especially if you're an officer at your local group, to keep it as kosher as possible. They don't expect you in Buddhism. There's no have to's necessarily. You're explained, you know, things, and it needs to make sense. And if it doesn't make sense, then either if you're honest with yourself, you can put it aside and maybe study something else. So, like the Buddha said, if you're given gold, you don't just assume what you've been given is gold. You test it to try and figure out if it's really what you've been given is gold. But so that's how you operate on an individual level. You question your lama. You question yourself. You question your reality. You sit and you meditate. You study, and it needs to make sense, right? But when you have a center for His Holiness, you're expected to run it in a certain way and offer certain practices. I mean, I don't just say this is what we're gonna study. We're gonna do meditation and Chenrezig because that's what Mike wants to do. That's what the 16th Karmapa, when she saw him in 1980, that's how he wanted his centers. In fact, he might have done it in 1974. But so it is very orthodox in one sense. And when you come into a center, like we've had lamas, and they come in and they look at it, and it's expected to be, the shrine is expected to look a certain way. The house is expected to be kept in a certain order. You know, you're expected to, you know, offer meditation. Like when you came in, I'm expected to offer you meditation. We don't pick up the cushions when there's new people. There's certain ways that they want things done. And I understand it's not my center. It's never been, it shouldn't be about the individual. So, mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's becoming more, they're trying to make it more uniform because of the 17th Karmapa. Is coming of age, and he's got his emissaries like Kempo Tenkyon that was here, and we would like to bring him back, who are going around to the centers and just kind of seeing what's going on and kind of preparing for when he starts to teach the 17th Karmapa. So
okay, great.
Yeah,
could you give an example of something that you think distinguishes the Kagyu lineage from other lineages, or perhaps even Tibetan more generally, like Tibetan generally from other forms of Buddhism?
Oh wow, that is a really loaded
question.
Oh my god, it's huge. So you're saying like the there are four lineages in Tibet, right?
Yeah.
You're familiar with that
yeah.
concept? And then at the new Kadampa, then you've got five or whatever. Now.
Sure.
Something
that's unique about the Kagyu lineage.
In context of the four lineages?
Sure. Yeah, let's do it in context of the four.
Well, you have the Karmapa, who's the head of the Kagyu lineage. And you have, in each individual lineage, you have certain specific practices that are unique to those individual lineages. And then you have, within the individual lineages, you have kind of a different structure of authority. But you also have kind of different, you have a different emphasis. For instance, the Gelugpa. The Gelugpa is the dominant ruling lineage in Tibet at this point. At one time, it was the Kagyu. And at one time before that, it was the Sakya. And prior to that, it was the Nyingma. They never really ruled. They were just a bunch of practitioners. Mm-hmm. So it's more Baptist, the Nyingma is. But the difference, like the fundamental one of them, and I'm no expert, it's huge. The fundamental, because it's a 1,500-year-old lineage, both of them. They're ancient. But you've got, with the Gelugpa, it's more practice-oriented. So when you are a neophyte within the Gelugpa, you're expected to study intensely. You're expected to study prior to practicing, right? And once you understand what you're doing, then you practice. With the Kagyu, it's completely different. They believe they're the practice lineage, right? They will sit you like doing Nundro. Man, you could walk in, you, and see a lama, and you just fall in love with the lama and say, I want to do Nundro, and which is heavy. And they'll be like, okay, you can do Nundro. You know, so if you are expected to do the practice, gain some experiential understanding, and then study. And or study along with it. It's not that there's no studying, but study is less emphasized.
Okay. Bouncing off of that, the order of tonight, we sat, we meditated for 40 minutes, and then we did a little bit of studying afterwards. And that was unique, because in the other groups I sat with, there was never a study portion, really. So I wonder, what do you think, what is the relationship between the studying after the meditation? Did they highlight each other? Oh, and I think I should point out, I thought it was interesting that even the dedication of merit was after the discussion.
Yeah.
So it's like the discussion seemed to me to be like a part.
It is.
Of it, right?
Yeah. Well, okay, there's a little tweak, and this might be kosher or non-kosher. It's just kind of what I've asked the Lama, and they just are like, oh, okay, that's good enough. Is, I don't like the... something that I've had to like get used to, and it's taken me a long time to understand why we do it, is a lot of the ceremony, right? And I, for a new person, like for instance, for me, when I saw the shrine, I'm like, why? Why is there a shrine? If the Buddha is in everything, why can't we just put a stick up there and say $500 on a Buddha statue? You know what I mean? And why do we pray? I mean, what's prayer? It doesn't make any sense. I mean, I was raised Christian, and I didn't understand it then, you know? So with the sitting meditation, I've always wanted it to be something a little bit less formal. And so if you come next week, very formal. Lots of chanting in Tibetan, lots of prayers, lots of dedications of merit. And so I don't really, like, at the end of the meditation, I'll put my own hands together and dedicate my own merit and let other people do whatever they do, right? But then after that sitting meditation, or I mean after the book discussion, and this is just me, you know, is I feel like you can't just, okay, shake hands, that's it. Because you do. I mean, I think after you start to bond like that and you understand and you kind of get to know one another, I think it's extremely important, because I think this is the foundation of why we do what we do in Buddhism, both for ourselves and for others, is that it's important that your motivation is correct. You have to be good at the beginning, good in the middle, and good at the end. And the good in the beginning is your motivation has to be to benefit yourself and to benefit others, right? good in the middle is you have to do the best you can with the practice. You know, it doesn't mean you have to be perfect, and you don't beat yourself up like, you know, tonight if you're having a hard meditation, that's fine. And then whatever benefit that you get, you dedicate that merit so that others can benefit. And so it's good at the end.
Yeah.
And I think that's important.
Okay. Is there any interaction between this group and other local area Buddhist groups?
Yeah, Shambhala, like Mary's awesome. Mm-hmm. Holy cow. So we've got Shambhala and Harold. You might have met Harold at Southwind. He's our Zen guy. He comes over. And I don't go anywhere because I'm lazy. I mean, this is enough for me to do once a week and not mess around with another group on a Saturday when I just want to ride my bike and take pictures or whatever. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And I'm glad Mary doesn't take, because she's invited me to the Shambhala, but I'm just not going.
Mm-hmm.
So there is, yeah. And a lot of the guys, like when Bartotoku came, he gave refuge. I mean, the number of Vietnamese were more than the white people, the Caucasians. There was, you know, so, and we always try to include the ethnic temples in, you know, when we have lamas and yeah. And then when I was here, Kenpo Tenkyong, what was funny, strange, I'm driving him around, we're just kind of killing time, and I'm taking him out to the temple out north of town, and it was after the Chinese New Year, and it was beautiful, it was, just looked awesome, and he was like, this is great. He's like, you don't even need a center here, you don't need the Karma, you don't need the KT, you don't need this. You've got this. And he was pointing at he's like, why don't you come here? Why do you even bother with it? And he wanted me to start, like, going there. I haven't. Mm-hmm. But he wanted me to, like, we talked to this guy, and he's, like, giving me pamphlets and stuff. And Kenpo Tenkyong, who is the Karma, who's the Karmapa's emissary, like, direct emissary, like, sent by the Karmapa here, was telling me, why don't you just go study with these guys? They got it going on. Which is weird to me in my mind. So anyway.
Hmm.
I forgot what the question was.
Has this group had any sort of interaction with non-Buddhist religious groups?
A little bit. I remember we used to have some interaction with Interfaith Ministries. And, we used to meet over at, what's the church on the corner of 21st and Oliver? It's a unity. It's not Unitarian, it's a unity church. And the minister loved us. He would come to the teachings, and he seemed to really appreciate what we were. The members at the church, I don't think did. Greg was a member of the church, and I don't think that they were very welcoming of a Buddhist. And we met over at, was it an Anglican church? Used to be a church over on 29th Street, and we met there. And the minister that we met used to be when he was growing up, he lived in a monastery, a Buddhist monastery. And he was more open at that time. I was kind of real fundamentalist Buddhist. You can get in the phase where my way is the right way. You don't realize you're being fundamentalist. And he kind of showed me what a Christian he was so happy that we were there. And we had a shrine bigger than that one. So, not that we've had, like, where we've shared teaching space or whatever, but we've had interaction. We've been in a lot of churches.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. So last question, it's just kind of a simple, open-ended, vague question, but it kind of encapsulates the theme of my project.
Okay.
What's it like being the Buddhist in Kansas?
You know, initially I thought, because I took refuge in 1996, which has started to be a long time ago for me. I mean, for a lot of, it's, and when I first took refuge, it was really wonderful for me individually, but I didn't want anybody to know about it. And but now you eventually can't hide from it, you know. Especially with Facebook, when people are reposting me with my hands together next to a Buddhist monk, or, you know what I mean? It becomes pretty obvious that Mike's a Buddhist. But people are really nice. I've never had somebody go be anything, but I personally think when people find out you're a Buddhist, and they are intrigued more than anything, you know? I've had no problems with it. And the only problem is my own head.
Yeah.
You know, thinking that person's going to be mean to me when they're not. I don't advertise it. I think it's ridiculous to put a bumper sticker on your car. I mean, some people do, but I don't. And the only advertisement I wear is just because I wear a protection cord, you know? But, I think that it rubs me the wrong way when people wear their deepest beliefs as a bumper sticker on their car. I mean, it just shows that they're trying to, because it's going to change. Your attitude toward, if you're open, your attitude towards to your own experience are going to change, regardless if you're a Buddhist or a Christian, you know. And if you get caught up in trying to believe one way, and then you just have, then you ignore reality as it's starting to slap you in the face and beat you down, I guess. I don't know. Anyway, but yeah, I've had no problem. I really haven't. I think people are open and sweet and genuine. But I've never been the person that had to. Because we've been at four churches now. We move a lot, and I've never had to deal with the board of directors or the pastor saying, "Hey, the board doesn't like you guys anymore." What? What did we do wrong? Well, you're Buddhist. You know.
Okay. Well, great.